Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that eight-show-a-week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is, in effect, built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Mark Kilmurray is a writer, director, and actor for theatre, film, television, and radio. He co-founded the Snarling Beasties Theatre Company in the UK with Debbie Issett. Mark first came to Australia in 1991 with the Snarling Beasties and moved permanently in 1996. He's currently the artistic director of the Ensemble Theatre in Kirribilli, Sydney, after first working there as an actor in 2002, then becoming associate director, co-artistic director, and from 2015, sole artistic director. Mark Kilmurray, welcome to the Stages podcast.
Thank you.
Nice to chat to you, especially
you
on this opening night, the 7th of December 2023, which is the finale for your 23 season, isn't it?
It is. It's our last opening night. It's very nice to be here.
Midnight Murder at Hamilton Hall.
Yes.
A play penned by yourself with Jamie Oxenbould, and you're also directing it. So I imagine that can be all-encompassing with all those roles.
It can be. The good thing with this play is that Jamie and I have known each other for 20 years, and I've worked with him a lot as an actor and me as director, and we also made a film together that I directed and he played the lead in. So we have a good chemistry. We know what we like in terms of comedy, and we knew we wanted to write a play about things going wrong in the theatre for a long time. And so it sort of was a combination of all those discussions. And then finally I rang him and said, hey, why don't we do it? And he said, oh, okay. So we wrote A Midnight Murder at Hamilton Hall, which is set in the world of amateur dramatics, and an amateur company are putting on a show that night, and then most of the cast are down with a unknown plague, and so three actors and a stage manager have to play all the roles for the opening.
Of course, a lot of theatre companies suffered, unfortunately, with a certain plague recently.
Yes,
where a lot of actors had come down with,
yes,
with COVID. And we're still seeing the residue of that today with companies having to deploy standbys and understudies.
Yes, we've just stopped our understudy programme, but for the last 2 years we had understudies waiting in the wings, as it were, to go on, and we use them more than once, so hopefully it's the tail end of all of that now.
Well, it is the old adage, isn't it, that the show must go on, I mean, because there's so much financially at stake for a company.
Yes, and that's the point of Midnight Murder, the show must go on, and the question is asked, why must the show go on if it's going to be a disaster? Because it just has to, and that's the answer, so and that's also the comedy of it.
There's been a great series of plays to do with things going wrong in the theatre. I mean, the play that goes wrong,
yes,
recently, that whole franchise. And, of course, that great classic Noises Off.
Yes, Michael Frayn, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, a long time. For me, in the 1980s, when I was at drama school, there was a company touring around who were a Women's Guild Amateur Dramatic Society, and they would tour pretending to be an actual amateur dramatic society, and people would go not knowing they were professional actors, pretending to be amateurs, and everything would go wrong that night. And it was absolutely incredible watching these productions, because you think, hold on a minute, is that supposed to be happening? Then realise, of course, it was, and it becomes even funnier. So that was in mind as well for Jamie and I when we talked about doing this. But of course, the play that goes wrong, and of course, Noises Off, yes. It's a great tradition. I think it's because we like seeing people slip on banana skins.
That Sheldon Friday.
Yes, and we're also thankful it's not us, and that it's funny when something goes wrong, and there's the idea that it can't. It's like laughing at school when the teacher says, be quiet. It's that terrible terror. But is also delicious.
Is it good to be at the end of the last play of your 23 season?
Yes, it's always nice to have made it.
but then you get that one done, and yes, we've got 2024 about to start.
That's right, yeah, almost immediately. Yes, we don't close apart from Christmas Day, public holidays around Christmas, and so yes, the next play goes into rehearsal next week, and then it opens at the end of January, which is Alone It Stands by John Breen, a fabulous play about the Munster rugby team, amateur rugby team, taking on the mighty All Blacks and beating them. And that's, there's no spoiler there, it's in the play. So five or six actors play something like 17 or 18 roles, plus a dog and a baby. It's very funny.
You're the third artistic director at the Ensemble Theatre after, yes, the great Hayes Gordon and Sandra Bates. What do you need to consider in programming a season for the ensemble audience?
Good question. I the audience is a thing to consider. I think that when you're putting a season together, for me it's about having a good variety of plays so that you're not hitting the same note on the piano, as it were, if you program similar plays one after the other. For instance, if they're all dramas or they're all comedies, I think there's something in a variety, then people have a wider choice. Plus, also, for me, fortunately, I like comedies. I like plays that you can come along and forget the outside world for a bit. But I also, of course, love drama. So there's a balance there that I hope that we've got right over the years. As I say, it's there's something for everyone. If I read a good play and it's a really good play, then I have to consider who's in it and will they come? And they're big questions, I think, in terms of successful programming.
And you nurture a lot of new playwrights, but of course there's the playwrights that we love to see perform, like David Williamson, yes, who has this lovely home at the Ensemble now.
Indeed.
And Joanna Murray-Smith, both of who are featured in, yeah, 2024.
Yes, David Williamson's, he retired, and now he hasn't. His first play out of retirement, which is great news. He emailed and said, sorry, Mark, to ruin the plaque on the wall, because we have a plaque of his time of writing plays. He said, but I've just written another one. And I was delighted, obviously, about the Great Divide, about the division in the country, which is very topical and popular, as all of David's work is. And Joanna Murray-Smith adapting Uncle Vanya for us. She did a great job with The Doll's House last year, so we're sort of looking at a trilogy, and we don't know what the third one is yet, but I'm thrilled to be... She nailed the story and the adaptation of Vanya so well, particularly with her humour, and matches it so well, we can't wait to do another.
I was delighted to see that you'd programmed Ulster American, which debuted at Outhouse Theatre, I think, last year or the year before. Lovely Jeremy there and that company, and an ensemble favourite with Brian Meekin
in the company.
But it's a very dark black comedy. It's
very dark black comedy. I saw that production, and I know Jeremy from many years. He did a play of mine when they were in New York, and it's always nice to see something you love in the independent sector and think, oh well, it needs another life, and so it's the same company doing it for us, just giving it five more weeks to do that great show. It is dark, but I think we're ready for it.
I guess it's a balance too of programming large cast players but also one person players, and we're seeing that with Masterclass, Terence McNally's.
Well, yes, one person apart from soprano singers, and so there's a cast of five, but the pianist and arranger. But yes, it is a balance, and unfortunately more and more, especially coming out of COVID, where we're all trying to sell more tickets and attendances are lower than they used to be. So yes, if I read a play and I think how many's in it, and then open the title page, think, oh, seven, then that's a harder journey. If it's a topical popular play, like for instance Noise Is Off, then there's a sort of guarantee people might come. But if it's more unknown, then it's more of a consideration now.
I saw Masterclass when it debuted in Broadway with the great Zoe Caldwell.
Oh,
And of course, I've forgotten that there are more people in it.
Yeah,
because it's such a... any leading lady who plays Maria Callas, they're both big personalities and sort of can shadow everyone else in the play.
When I remembered it and thought, oh, it'd be great to do Masterclass, because I saw it with Robin Nevin in the 90s at the STC, and I, exactly the same as you, thought there was a pianist and maybe a singer. And then when I thought, oh, no, there's three singers. So, yes, it's interesting that, though, isn't it? That remembrance of theatre and what we remember and what we don't.
Yeah,
I think it's very fascinating.
Of course she is. She needs to deliver a masterclass to students.
Yes, that's right, to somebody. yes.
And Melanie Tate has a new play, of course, great success with the Appleton Ladies' Potato Race.
Yes, that was great. Awesome. And last year she did a broadcast coup. So this is the third play we're doing for Melanie, The Queen's Nanny, which is about the Queen Mother and the nanny, Crawfy, who was the nanny to the princesses. And she then asked permission if she could write a book, a memoir about her time bringing the two, the Queen and Princess Margaret, up. And they said, no, please don't. And then she did. And so they all fell out with her. And this is the story of what happened next. It's a great piece and a sort of unknown story too.
That's the most exciting thing about theatre, isn't it? It opens all sorts of doors and windows to stories that otherwise would not be told, we would not be aware of.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And it's especially when it's historical and you think, oh, wow, I had no idea that this... same with Black Cockatoo, with Johnny Muller, the idea that the first cricket team that went overseas was an Indigenous cricket team, and that was incredible to me that I didn't know that story.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic, yeah.
Did you know the nanny story?
No, not at all. No, not until Mel said, hey, I've got this idea.
Oh,
I thought, well, yep, let's do that. And it's great at the moment. We have it's great to develop those relationships with new writers, Sam O'Sullivan, Mel Tate, and Joanna Smith, not just emerging but also established, that we have a pool, a commissioner's circle pool, so people can put money into this pool, which means then we can commission a writer and then also into development for the play, which means that we can continue a relationship with the writer. So it's not just their first new wonderful play, it's also having a conversation over years with that writer's voice, not just for us, but if the play is published, which we're doing at the moment, then other theatre companies. The Appleton Ladies' Potato Race just finished at the QTC, so it's great. For me, that's the lifeblood of Australian theatre. It's new work having a history.
And indeed, that became a Netflix film.
It did, yes, that's right, it did, yes. Yes, I'm yet to see it, but I will. But it was great to know that it started here.
Yeah, of course, of course. Now, Mark, you grew up in the UK.
Yes.
What were the artistic influences in your childhood?
Well, my dad was an engineer. So he worked for Triumph. So he would bring home lovely Triumphs for us to drive around at the weekends. So he was a draftsman, a senior draftsman he became. But my mum, they got divorced when I was 8. My mum was very creative and got into, with her brother was a writer. So they both started writing for television, for the BBC. So they wrote for Dave Allen, the Two Ronnies. My mum wrote sketches for all sorts of sketch shows on at the time. And then she wrote short stories, horror stories, and plays. And so I ended up doing a couple of her plays on the amateur world, which is probably the experience for the latest play that we do. And then from there, met actors at the local drama school who encouraged me to go along to the drama school. So that is all my mum's fault. And when I said I wanted to be an actor, she tried to persuade me not to be. Whereas my dad, because I was hopeless at everything I'd tried to do, said, oh, thank goodness. He was so pleased that I found something that I wanted to do. So from my mum's side, probably. Although my dad was a huge film buff, loved films. So we would go... Because they were divorced, we'd have Sundays with Dad, and he would always take us to the local flicks and go and see a double bill of something or other, which was fantastic.
What about school? Was there any sort of drama outlet there, or productions? Right?
Had a great drama teacher and a great English teacher who encouraged me. I was not the best school pupil. I went to art school when I first left school, so I could draw and and not be bullied because I draw pictures for people for for favours, and I think, okay, they won't pick on me. And also I was the comedian, so if I fell off the desk and made people laugh, they tended not to beat you up. It was a comprehensive school, Cullerdon Castle, and it was a grammar school, but it had the sort of echo and the fallout from being a grammar school, and a lot of the teachers there didn't want it to be a comprehensive, and they were sort of ex-army teachers, and a lot of caning and beating and, you know, shouting and screaming, none of which you could do today, thank goodness. And it's a matter of survival almost. But there were some great teachers, as my English teacher and art teacher, who encouraged me with that world. But mostly I didn't do very well at exams and left at 16 and went to art school.
So in the study of literature or English at school, were you studying plays? I mean, there was always a play that came up in Year 9 or Year 10 English. Do you remember what?
Yes.
Shakespeare?
It was A Merchant in Venice, and it was read, passed around. The book would be passed around by lots of 14-year-old boys, not interested at all, reading Shakespeare so badly. It put me off Shakespeare for at least 10 years until I got into drama school. Plays, the play that stuck out was Zigazaga, which is a play about a football hooligan, as they call them, going to see his favourite team that we saw at the local Belgrade Theatre. And that was a real influence on me, because it was suddenly, I thought, oh, this is about something, and I could identify with the lead character. And it was also dynamic, and it broke the sort of the fourth wall. And I felt that was really interesting. And because my mum loved theatre, she worked at the local Belgrade Theatre as a secretary to the production manager. So I'd go and see all the musicals. And I remember seeing Pyjama Game on the opening night. A guy slipped as he went to do a song, and it was all around the audience. It terrified me of live theatre. But it was also fascinating how he got through that and made it work. So I think all those influences helped me on my way to do what I do now.
So going off to art school, was there a thought that you may have been a draftsman or a designer of some sort?
Well, when I said at school, there's a film called Kez, which is about a boy in a kestrel, and my school wasn't quite as bad as that, but it's around that sort of area. So to say to a careers teacher in Coventry in the 1970s, I want to be an artist, they go, oh, well, have you tried being a printer? Or have you, you know, they're practical answers to any creativity. And so I went to work in a printer's after I left art school. Not a draftsman, I was terrible at. I didn't take after my dad at all. But because I could draw, I went to art school for 2 years, but I only lasted a year because I just couldn't afford not to be making money. So then I went first on the dole, as everybody seemed to be in the late 70s, and then to a printer's, and the boss there, Pronto Print, looked after me. I was hopeless at most things apart from serving customers. So he kept me on for years, even though he really should have got rid of me before then, and it was very good to me. And when I said I was leaving to be an actor, he was absolutely delighted. I'm probably glad to get rid of me.
So you must have met some creative types to hear about drama school. Or...
only through my mum did these plays, and a couple of the students were in a few of the roles in those plays. And as we were packing up, I was playing one of the two roles in the plays. They said, why don't you try out for the local drama school, Coventry Centre for the Performing Arts? And it was a very small school run by ex-actors and directors who were fantastic and were really enthusiastic about being an actor and what you needed to be and what you needed to do. And because they'd been in the world, they were their stories were great, their practicality of how to be an actor was fantastic, the way they addressed acting, it was very exciting. So they said, why don't you audition? And I hadn't really thought about acting, funnily enough, even though I was in this place. And I was going to get married at the time, and I said to my wife then, I might audition. And she said, sure, and we would get a grant. So I went along with my friend who was re-auditioning and got in, and which was... I think one reason I got in, I did okay in the audition, the improvisations, but when the head, Bobby Pryor Pitt, who was this lovely man who ran the drama school, he said, what are you going to do? What are you doing as a job? I said, oh, I'm working. I've left my job. And he said, what? How? I said, to come here. And this was July, and I didn't start till September. And he said, you've given up your job to come here and this is the audition today. And I said, yeah. And so he must have thought, I was so determined to get into drums. We've got to get him a place because he's just given his job up. And my wife at the time was working, so it seemed to work out. We then got divorced and I went off to be an actor.
Do you remember what you auditioned with? What piece?
I do. It was Riley in Enter a Free Man, Tom Stoppard play. I was 22 and playing a 35-year-old, which I felt was fine. And I also did a Wilfred Owen poem about being unwashed, in the which was a beautiful piece. And the woman there who ran the poet side of the drama school was, I could see she really enjoyed the poem that came, my mum's suggestion. And Enter a Free Man, I just loved the fact that Richard Briers had played it. And I was a big fan of Richard Briers from The Good Life at the time. I thought, oh, I can sort of do that. And one of the lecturers, David Hankin, who was a very good acting teacher, said, does Riley, in his heart of hearts, think he's going to be an actor? And I said, no, he doesn't. And I think that must have been the right answer. He went, okay.
Right.
So he nodded and wrote something down. So I think that combination got me in, got me through the door. But it was a great school, 2 years, Stanislavski-based, fantastic people went there. Clive Owen was one of the famous actors who went through that school. And because it was smaller, they could spend more time with you. If I'd gone to RADA, I don't think I'd have survived, really. Mm-hmm. I wasn't from a very wealthy background, so I was among people who were either wanting to be actors or just wanting to do something to express themselves. And I thought that was a wonderful philosophy with the school too.
Drama school can expose us to various methods of acting, obviously Stanislavski-based, where you went, but also practitioners. Was this the first time that you may have encountered Berkhoff and the theatre of Stephen Berkhoff?
Yes, well, that was Debbie Isaac. Debbie's a good friend of mine still, and she's did the film Nativity recently, and she's had huge hits on the West End with that play and with other plays, musicals, etc., and films. And she and I read, she read Berkhoff's play East. Around the second year, we were all about to leave, and on the bus, she said, read this play called East, and I started reading it, and it was completely shocking and outrageous. I'd never read anything like it. But because we were into physical theatre, whereas it's truthful, naturalistic acting, but it explodes into, say, slow motion or dance or whatever that might be, we loved the combination of that in Berkhoff's work. We had a great mime teacher, Jeff Buckley, another Jeff Buckley, who and I loved mime, so I was a street mime for a while. So it sort of combined that idea of acting for me as well. So we read East, and then that night Debbie rang me, said, someone's doing East. We were thinking of doing it ourselves. I said, who's doing that? And she said, a company called the Snarling Beasties Theatre Company. And I said, what a great name. She said, yeah, that's the name. We're going to go and we're going to do it. So we were doing East, so we did it at the local theatre, the year after leaving drama school, formed our own company and put the play on. And it went off. It was great.
So was it the two of you that were the founding members of Snarling
Yes.
Beasties?
Yes, there's five of us, but right. Debbie and I were the two founding. And then the other actors came on as company members, but we were the founders, yeah. So Debbie directed, I was in playing the leads mostly. And then it changed that Debbie wrote and directed and I played the leads, and Debbie was acting too. So sometimes there were two-handers. We did Punch and Judy, The Real Story, and Femme Fatale, that were big hits at the Edinburgh Festival, and that's when we went to the Donmar Warehouse and toured internationally and then came to Sydney Festival in 1991 doing those two plays. Yeah, that's why I'm here.
That's Snarling Beasties.
Yes, because we did that show, and then a woman came in to interview me who we thought were the ABC, found out that she was 2SER. That was fine. She was a very nice interview. And then afterwards she said, what beaches have you been to? And we said, Bondi. She said, you got to go to a real beach, freshwater or northern beaches. So I said, oh, great. And the whole company was supposed to go. But Debbie and her boyfriend at the time got very badly sunburnt, bathing on top of the hotel in King's Cross. And so it's just me. And so Jackie took me, and Jackie now is my wife. So,
how romantic.
from that interview, great things started. Yeah.
Fantastic. Let's talk about Berkhoff Theatre for a moment. Mm. I mean, can't think of more than any other playwright. It's so theatrical, it's heightened, it's expressionistic, it's physical, it's the language.
Yes, it's Shakespearean, with a mix of Cockney Shakespeare, heightened language, great characters to play. I played Les in the East. He has this great monologue about working in the back of a shop, and having worked in the back of a shop before I went to drama school, I could identify with it. He was very clever at the time, very 80s. You'd be hard pressed to do a Berkoff play now, I think. You'd have to have quite a few warnings up in the foyer. But he was talking about people he knew and the world that he grew up in. He's quite a controversial figure as well. But at the time, we loved him. And most people our age, in early, mid-20s, were massive Berkoff fans. And so we loved doing the plays. And we toured quite a lot with East. And then Debbie's work, Punch and Judy particularly, was in rhyming couplets. So there was an influence for her writing and our work after that. And then my play was a play about one shot, about a guy obsessed with Robert De Niro. That sort of had that sense of theatricality as well.
I think the term in your face theatre has
been that's absolutely right.
Given to Berkoff.
It is. But he was anti everybody else, and that probably didn't do him a huge amount of favours, but he just wanted to push the boundaries of what theatre could be in Britain, because his influences were Greek theatre, European theatre, and he felt that the British theatre had become very safe and sort of box drawing room productions, and he just wanted to smash that idea, and he did. And it was very influential for a lot of companies. Theatre Complicité were around at the same time as us, so we would often tour in the same venues and chat about that idea of pushing the boundaries. And
One shot, it's about a Robert De Niro obsessed fan.
Yes.
You're a big fan of De Niro also, I believe.
I was, yes. Yeah. Well, still am.
And has that come out of going to the cinema with your dad?
Yes, I think so. Well, I think for me it was American cinema of the 70s. I loved Al Pacino, Robert De Niro. Again, when you're starting out there, you're icons and idols. I started as an actor to be a film actor. That's what I wanted to be. That's what I loved. I was a big James Dean, Marlon Brando, Monty Clift, all those method acting actors. That's was my love and passion. I'd watch films. My mum's a big film buff as well, and my dad, as I say. So De Niro is part of that. The fact that I've done theatre for nearly 40 years and not actually much film is interesting, because it was interesting when theatre kicked in. I thought, actually, this is what I really want to do, not necessarily film. But De Niro is a part of that. And so it was more about, I went to see Taxi Driver in London. It was a retro showing when I was living in London in the 90s. And Jackie had just come over to stay in London with me. And I saw a Taxi Driver on the big screen. I'd only ever watched it on video. And it was so powerful, even though I knew it was amazing. And I thought, what if somebody's obsessed with Robert De Niro, as Robert De Niro in the film is obsessed with Jodie Foster's character? And so there were sort of certain layers going on there of playing a fan who's playing De Niro, I'm a fan like of De Niro. So that's where the basis of the play came from. So I wrote it in London, and then we were coming back to Australia, I rang Belvoir Street and said, hey, have you got any spaces for a one person? They said, yeah, come over and do it in November. Those days have gone now. But I was like, okay. And this was like August or something. So then I came over and did it at Belvoir, and then toured all over the world doing it. I went everywhere doing it. And New York, and Scorsese's assistant came to see it. And so it was quite a buzz. And it's always amazing to me when you write something in a room, you know, on your own, that then can take you around the world. It's incredible.
Do you remember many of your reviews as an actor? Because I just came across one.
Okay.
When you were in Femme Fatale.
Braces himself. Oh, okay.
Right. Yes, the Financial Times reassuringly commented that Mark Kilmurry is convincingly butch, even in his little black dress.
Oh, yes.
Of course, you're playing a transvestite in Femme Fatale.
Yeah, Femme Fatale was... So Punch and Judy with Debbie and I became, was a big hit at the Edinburgh Festival in 89. And then Debbie went and we researched transvestism because Debbie was really interested at that time in gender politics. And so she came up with this great play. And then it was about a transvestite married to his wife who then dresses up. And Femme Fatale was the Lou Velvet Underground song that we played over it, which we asked Lou Reed if we could use it, and because we couldn't afford it. And he said, yes, us girls need to stick together, and gave us the rights for free, which we thought was very nice. So the play was a physical theatre, but it was about the dilemma of someone who dresses up in female attire and with his wife who doesn't understand. And it was really successful. And then that took us into the Del Mar warehouse after doing Punch and Judy, and again around the world. So it was... It was great. And it sort of put us on the map as a company, I suppose, that play. Yeah.
Have the plays been published from Snarling Beasties? Sound fascinating.
Woman Who Cooked Her Husband has, and plays after that. But Punch and Judy and Femme Fatale never were. And also we filmed them a few times and, of course, lost all the videotapes of everything that we ever did, you know, in those days. And it was all on video and you send them off to producers and then they would never come back. They were great plays. They're really good plays to do. 200s, and we toured them as double bills as well. So we did them both on the same evening sometimes, which killed us. But in terms of reviews, it was great at that time to get that reassurance of what we were doing was going well. But you can never rely on a good review. You know, you always have to just be truthful to the work, as you know. It's if you start going down the path of they're like this, then you're stuffed, really.
Do you read reviews now for your work as an actor?
I have to,
or a writer? Yeah,
I do for the company. I try to not read reviews as soon as they come out, and give myself a few days, and then maybe the week after. But then people send them to you, or they say, sorry about the review, or they say, hey, great review. So then you go, oh, I better go and read it, because it feels like everyone's talking about you. They don't quite have the, he says in advance of a play happening, they don't quite have the sting that they used to, and they don't quite have the cachet of people coming as much as they used to, because social media, because of lots of other ways of getting the news out there, which is a great thing. For us here at the Ensemble, word of mouth is and reviews matching is always the best way. And word of mouth, even if a review hasn't been great, can bring people in, because that's, you know, normal people talking about the play and being entertained rather than one person's opinion, you know.
So you meet an Australian, you marry an Australian, you move to Australia.
Yes.
What was life then? Was as a freelance actor?
Yes, well, written... So, yes, it was. So I did the play at Belvoir, and then I came... one shot and a play about James Dean I did at the Sydney Theatre Company in 97 in the studio space, as Wolf Tuna. And Wayne Harrison was there at the time and opened the doors for me. It was very lovely that I could do that. So I did that, but I found it really hard. When I first moved here, end of 96... I was basically starting again. Debbie had gone off to do films and work herself, so we'd sort of, you know, a bit of the Beatles, we'd gone our separate ways. But
was that difficult to realise? I mean, obviously things came up in your own lives. And...
Yeah, a little bit, because we'd been successful. Debbie wanted to go in a different direction. I wanted to go in a different direction. I think so. I think we could have stayed together and done a couple more shows, but yeah, life things you know, change things. So. And so we went our separate ways for a while, and we're still great mates. So, you know, it was for the best in lots of ways. And we keep talking about working together again. I say, we're getting a bit older now. We need to do that sooner than later. But it was hard, because then I came here and I had to get an agent and I had to, you know, start all over again. And Sydney has its own, you know, own rules and own setup, and lots of people know each other from NIDA or from wherever they... The drama schools or different theatres, so I was a real outsider. So I went backward and forward to the UK, and also we managed to get work done at the Santa Fe Festival in New Mexico, some plays on with the Snarling Beasties, and I took one shot there, and James Dean another. James Dean was commissioned by the Santa Fe Festival, met an actor there, wrote a play for the Santa Fe. So I went for 3 or 4 years, I went to this festival. That got me and Jackie a green card, So then we were going to go and move to New York. And in the meantime, I did Japes here with Sandra. And in 2003, she said, do you want to be associate director? Because she knew I was directing and writing and not just an actor. And I said, oh, great. She said, that starts in 2005. So we went to New York for 6 months instead of for good, thinking I'll probably be able to juggle both. And but then came here to start the associate director in 2005, and that was it.
how did Japes come about? Was that just through an open audition or something, through your agent? Or?
Well, the ensemble, and we still do, it doesn't happen as much now, but they had a policy, anyone could come and read any play in the season. And I, someone called me and said, you should read Japes. It's a Simon Gray play. It's a great play. Have a look at it. So I came in and read it. I read half of it and I thought, I can't quite get this, ironically, from what my job now. And I thought, I'm not so sure. But then I finished it and I didn't bother saying I want to audition. Then I met Danny Mitchell, who became a good friend of mine. I didn't know him very well at the time. He said, and he saw me in a play, Happy as Larry and Viv, that I wrote and was in playing Laurence Olivier with Susie Lindemann, who's playing Vivian Lee at the Belvoir Street downstairs. And he saw me in that and he said, look, you should come and read Japes because we're supposed to be brothers and we look a bit like each other. So he pitched me to Sandra, who didn't know me particularly. So then she came and saw... No, she didn't see it, actually. She said, oh, OK, let's have a read. So I had a read in the restaurant here. And afterwards, Sandra said, you got the role. Which was the lead role in a play with the Simon Group 3.5. Fantastic play. An alcoholic, he had to fall over, had to die. It was all the great things. Michelle Doak was also in the play with me. And Danny was my brother. And so Sandra, so our first time I met Sandra, she said, hello, and come in. And that was it, I was here. So we did the great play. It was a fantastic production. And then after that, I got a play called Auntie and Me the next year. And then that's when she offered me the associate director. And in between, I'd done my own plays, Happy as Larry and Viv and Mercy Thieves, which is a sort of gangster play I did at Darlinghurst when it first opened. So all those things accumulated in being in here. But a couple of years before Japes, I was in Cyrano de Bergerac at the Sydney Theatre Company. And that was with Jeremy Sims with Cyrano. And that was, I was playing De Guiche, the baddie. And that was a sort of a bit of a breakthrough for me because then I met a whole heap of actors who lived and worked here. Jeremy Sims, we became good friends, and my friend John Trutwin and I then sort of formed a company, as I'd done 10 years before, putting on Mercy Thieves, and we did Hamlet, and we formed the studio company with Patrick McIntyre, who then worked at the Sydney Theatre Company later. So everything then started to join. You know, it took a while, though. I had to go backward and forward to the UK a while before anything like that happened here. But it always sort of does if you persevere, I think,
yeah.
And have support.
Yeah, we have no idea what's down the track, what's in the future. But at the time of Japes, did it feel like a home? I mean, I've only had the opportunity to work once at the ensemble,
right.
and there was there's an amazing sense of well, it sounds cliche, but family, of community. Yeah. It does feel like a lovely home and a place to work. Did it feel like that for you at Japes?
Absolutely, it was. As soon as I walked in, and Sandra said, hello, come in, and it was so welcoming. Everybody was happy, friendly, and I felt like it reminded me of some of the theatres that I used to work at in the UK, where you could be yourself, you didn't have to pretend, and I like that now. Even now people say they like working here because they could just, you don't have to pretend to be smart or clever or arty, or just be daggy, be yourself. You know, if you like James Bond movies, that's good too. You know, it's just, and that's the idea and the philosophy behind it, I think. And then you do good work, I think. So under Sandra, I felt it was just a great place to work. Everyone was just lovely and supportive of the work. It was all about the work, not the ego, and that was fantastic as well. So, yeah, I loved it. I loved doing that production and being here, and I remember when it finished thinking, oh, I'd love to work here again, and then was offered something else, so that was good. But it was a very welcoming place, and hopefully that's still the way it is.
Well, the ensemble is quite an achievement. It is Australia's longest-running theatre, professional theatre, at about 65 years now. It started in 1958.
That's right, next year. 65, that's right, yeah, it's amazing. And to be only the third artistic director in all that time is quite an honour. Really.
Well, that says something about the place as well.
Yeah. And people do leave and go to other work and then they come back. You just see the same person coming back again because I think it's just a great, as I say, a great friendly place to exist in.
Yeah. And not subsidised, is it? It's just you rely on the box office.
Entirely,
as
yes.
Subscribers.
Yes, we did. We had help over COVID, which was lovely for Creates. New South Wales helped us a lot. And we have project funding, and we have some great philanthropy work with the Belknaise Foundation and people who help us, and great boards. Chair Graham Bradley and Paul Clitheroe are fantastic as the chair of the boards. So we have two good boards set up too. But it's all about support, philanthropy, and yes, people digging into their pockets to help us. We do occasionally get funding, and we keep applying for it. Yeah.
As a director, an actor, and a playwright, you're very much a theatrical beast. Are you superstitious in the theatre?
That's interesting, because yes and no. I think, you know, saying the Scottish play out loud, so you see, I won't say it. But I also don't really believe, because that the idea of the Scottish play, if a theatre did a play and they're doing that particular play, it meant they were in trouble, because they knew bums on seats would come in to see that play. So if you saw that play outside on an awning, you go, okay, that company's in trouble. That's sort of where it comes from.
Right.
But the curse thing is crazy. I think I honour other people's superstitions and try not to be superstitious, but, you know, it sort of filters through. I think you just hedge your bets either way, really.
You could whistle quite happily at the ensemble, because there's no flies.
You could, yes, that's right. That's where that comes from, yes, indeed. But you still don't, you know. I remember being told off for whistling when I first started out, and I had no idea you couldn't whistle in the theatre. And they explained that the flies would come down or go up, depending on the whistle. Yes and no. Opening night, I try not to do routines, or try not to, fall into that trap, because I think you can't control stuff. But there's a lot of OCD out there, so I think, and particularly for me. So yes, a little bit probably.
You've arrived at another opening night with Midnight Murder at Hamilton Hall. What do you do on opening nights? Just to centre yourself, to support the cast?
Yes, support the cast, give out little cards, thank yous. I try to stay away as long as I can, if I can, to come into the theatre as late as I can, because if I sit here, then I'll just get nervous. And when I arrive, if I arrive earlier for a meeting, if that's what's happening, then I'll go for a walk around the park, breathe a lot. Yeah, centre, and just focus on what you can't. I think some of the things you can control, which is in terms of directing the play and being practical about what you're trying to do with the play, and things you can't control, reviewers, how the audience are going to react, all of that. So you just, over the years, I think I've learned a little, it depends who you talk to let that go a bit, you know, and think, well, what will be, you know, in the end.
Well, honouring superstition, I will not say good luck, but I'll say chookers and break a leg.
Thank you.
For Midnight Murder at Hamilton Hall, which is playing until the 14th of January,
yes.
2024.
Yeah.
And then I think a fortnight after that, your season 2024 starts.
That's right, I learn stands, and then I'm into rehearsal for The Great Divide, yeah, with the fabulous Georgie Parker and Kate Raison, John Wood, so I'm looking forward to that hugely. Yeah.
Mark Murray, a delight to talk to you.
Thank you too. Thank you. Thank you.
Mark Kilmurray has just opened Midnight Murder at Hamilton Hall, a play he has co-authored with Jamie Oxenbould. Mark also directs the production. It is the opening night of director-writer Shane Tweed's new murder mystery. Jamie Oxenbould and Mark Kilmurray's new comedy looks behind the scenes at the world of amateur theatre, where luck, determination and unbridled confidence rule the day. A very funny take on bad timing, incompetence and sweet optimism to end the 2023 season at the Ensemble Theatre. Midnight Murder at Hamilton Hall plays the Ensemble Theatre in Sydney from the 1st of December 2023 to the 14th of January 2024. I'm Peter Ayres, keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time, you know where, on Stages.